When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Oh, hey, Mets fans. Welcome back to Today Your Love, Tomorrow the World Series. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. And Chris, the Mets just finished their first West Coast swing of the year. They went 3-3, taking two from the Dodgers and taking one from the Giants. After the first two Dodgers wins, it seemed a little bit like the Mets were never going to lose again. They had won six straight, I believe it was. Was it six or seven, Chris? What was their win streak?
Six in a row.
That's what I thought. Yeah. And then, you know, got blown out by the Dodgers in the last game, lost the first game of the Giants series, but, you know, rebounded nicely. So in our weekly vibe check, how are you feeling about the Mets as of right now?
Pretty solid. No complaints really about the road trip. Obviously, you would love to see them win both series, but a 3-3 trip against two, obviously the Dodgers are one of the elite teams in baseball, and the Giants maybe aren't, but I'd say they're a team that's not embarrassing to lose a game or two against. That can happen. So it's funny, every time a West Coast trip comes up, I always go back to that one that they had, and I think it was 2006, where they just dominated. It was a longer West Coast trip.
Yes.
And they were just fantastic. That is the absolute ideal scenario for that. But 3-3, still sitting above 500, feels like we can't really complain after they started 0-5. They've got a pretty good shot here to make it to May 1st at or above 500. And that alone is contending in this version of Major League Baseball. So,
I believe they would, if the season ended today, they would be the third wildcard team, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, a few weeks ago, not only are they 0-5 to start the season, but you're looking at the schedule and saying they got four with the Braves coming up. They've got the Dodgers this month. Those seven games that were on the schedule, one of them in Atlanta wound up being rained out, but those seven games alone could have been sort of season enders, given the start that they had and just the quality of the opposition. So the fact that they've won 4 of 6 from the Braves and Dodgers, does that mean that they'd be the favored team or have a really good shot in a playoff series? Probably not, but better than I think we could have expected. And I don't think they're firing on all cylinders yet. We can get into specifics. The bullpen has been excellent. Maybe it's not quite this good over the course of a full season, but I would think that the lineup, especially with the addition of JD Martinez, can make up for that. And there's room for improvement in the rotation too. So,
yeah, I feel similarly to how you feel in terms of the general state of the team right now. You know, like I said before, it would have been nice to win both of those series against the Dodgers and the Giants, but taking 2 or 3 from the Dodgers in the manner in which they did was great. And, you know, you never want to see somebody, a team get, you know, blown out and trounced, but I'd almost rather see them lose that game in the fashion they did against the Dodgers, because it sort of seems like, you know, your team's gonna get blown out now and then. These things happen to every single baseball team, and so let them take the blowout loss. It was Adrian Hauser, who I feel like is going to become a frequent target of scorn for you and I on this podcast. But maybe he can do what Harrison Bader did and use our ire towards him to prove us wrong. So your move, Mr. Hauser, go right ahead and hate us and prove us wrong with your with a better performance. But no, you know, it's it was a nice road trip. The team seems to be, you know, weathering the loss of Francisco Alvarez, which we'll talk about in a minute, reasonably well so far. You know, the offense hasn't totally cratered without Alvarez in it. Like you said, JD Martinez is going to be here. By the time this episode gets released, possibly you will have already watched JD Martinez play his first game as a Met. So, you know, there is help on the way in that regard. I think there's also some reasonable optimism to be had around the rotation being a little bit better, as you mentioned, Chris. You know, we are still about at least a month away from Kodai Senga's return from the injured list, but that will obviously have a huge impact on the rotation when he returns. You know, we have not seen, outside of Sean Manaea and one of the Severino starts, we have not seen like truly dominant starting pitching from this team yet. And while I don't think that that's going to be the case for the entire rotation or even for the bulk of the starts that they get, I think this team is capable of putting up, you know, above average starting pitching more frequently than they've been putting it up so far. That's I mean, I'm hedging like all over the place here, but I just feel like this team has a lot of room for improvement without crazy things happening. Like, you know, I everyone who listens to this podcast for long enough knows I went to college in Pittsburgh. One of my friends was a huge Pirates fan, and he would say things all the time like, you know, if we can find someone to take Derek Bell off our hands, you know, we can get this great, you know, we'll trade Derek Bell to the Yankees, and like, he would do these preposterous trades to somehow make himself feel better about the state of the Pirates. And like, that's just not realistic ever. The Mets have a chance to be really good. Well, not really good. The Mets have a chance to be greatly improved just by like the natural order of things happening the way it should. A couple of more decent starting pitching performances, a little bit more offense from guys who have maybe had a slow start. And all of a sudden this team looks, you know, considerably better than the team that we're looking at right now, which is still a team that is performing, you know, to decent, it's doing it right. Man, this is the most, I have such a sinus allergy brain today. This is just, the team's doing fine. team's doing fine. Jesus Christ. We should talk about Francisco Alvarez quickly. So last week, after we recorded, Alvarez had the third game in a row where he tweaked his thumb a little bit. This time he was rounding first base and stumbled and reached out his hand to brace himself on the ground and tore the ligament in his thumb. This comes a day after sliding into second base pretty hard with that thumb, and 2 days after a catcher's interference call where he got hit in the thumb with a bat. So, you know, clearly he is, you know, the thumb was an issue for the last, you know, couple of days he was playing, but it really became an issue when the ligament got torn. And, you know, you never want to see a player get hurt. You never want to see a young player get be out for 6 to 8 weeks is the expected recovery time, supposedly. You know, you never want to see that ever. But in terms of how bad things could have been watching that play, I'm thankful this is all that went wrong. How do you feel about this injury situation?
Yeah, about the same. I think one thing we've heard so much about is that Francisco Alvarez has this just kind of incredible work ethic. He's always playing hard. This is probably a play and an example of finding the right balance between that and sort of being a durable player over the course of 162 and hopefully more games per year. Obviously, a catcher is never going to play all those games, but yeah, you don't want to tell somebody to dial it back or tone it down when that approach has gotten them to the level that they're at. But in his case, it's two parts of it too. I hope people remember that he got hurt hustling.
Yes.
That is the cause here. And then the other side of that is just, I love the effort, but was that necessary in that situation? And that's where I would just love to see him find that balance. Not critical really of him, just one of those things to maybe consider moving forward, because I think the fact that he's hit okay overall, but he hadn't been off to, I mean, he came out of the gate hot, but he cooled off kind of substantially. In the short term, that probably makes it a little easier to absorb his absence. But when you don't want to go too far beyond these next 2 months with Narvaez and Nito as your go-to options behind the plate. Look, it's entirely possible too that Alvarez is a major defensive upgrade from either of those guys. I know Nito had gotten some praise before the Mets got Narvaez, and Nito wound up mostly playing in Syracuse. But yeah, he'll be missed. I don't think it's an insurmountable sort of situation for the Mets. And obviously JD Martinez coming in and essentially being what the ideal version of Alvarez is, a middle of the order power bat. That is fortunate timing.
Yes.
Obviously it would be better to have both of them in the lineup, but yeah, here we are. I do just hope that it's, I think they initially said 6 to 8 weeks, and then shortly after said definitely more on the 8 week side, but I hope it's just that. And I hope it's not something where we get into waiting until August,
right,
for him to return.
Yeah. Cause then you'll get the insufferable baseball discourse of this is like a trade acquisition deadline, or a trade deadline acquisition, which is maybe my least favorite thing in all of baseball analysis. When people say that, makes me absolutely bonkers. Yeah. So let's hope to not get any of that. But also, yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I'm with you. I know Alvarez works very, very hard, and I'm sure that he's going to do everything he can to get back ASAP. But that said, I also don't need him to try to rush his way back and then take more time. I'd rather him take the time now, be conservative about his approach, and allow in those 8 or 10 weeks, whatever it is, to come back healthy and not be in the situation we seem to be in all the time as Mets fans, where injuries just linger and the recovery time is always twice what we were told it is.
Yeah.
You and I have talked about that too, how I'm sure that happens for all fan bases, but as we are Mets fans, we can only really understand it from the Mets perspective. So I'm sure that happens to other teams' players too, but it always seems like it happens to the Mets.
Oh, yeah.
Going back, like, my entire Mets fandom, pretty much.
And to a certain extent, those feelings are justified, because especially now that the Wilpons are 95% out of the picture, and no longer involved in running the team or being any substantial part of it. You've heard more of those stories. Some of them came out while they were still around. But when you're hearing from the likes of Pedro Martinez that Jeff Wilpon was in the clubhouse personally sort of badgering guys and making them feel like they had to play, I mean, even still a little bit of a sore spot, I think, for Mets fans, the fact that Zach Wheeler is pitching in Philadelphia and not for the Mets at this point very likely goes back to Wilpon ownership, seeing him as somebody who wasn't healthy enough or willing to pitch through injuries enough, in their opinion, to invest in keeping him around. And objectively, I've been a little bit surprised at how durable and how good he turned out to be.
Agreed. Yes.
But to just dismiss the idea of bringing him back, and we saw it in the Brody Van Wagenen comment too. It was just a half season that was good. And at the time, or a half season that was like great or whatever it was that he said. And that was true at the time, but yeah. So yeah, I think it does happen a little bit throughout sports. And I think whether or not there's sort of bad motives from ownership to push guys to do things they shouldn't do, injuries are just tricky sometimes. And I mean, I know when I've had minor semi-athletic injuries of my own, they feel like they can take forever to recover. And I'm not trying to get back to playing a sport at an elite level, right? I'm like trying to be able to run a couple miles a few times a week. And that is difficult to recover from a sprain or, you know, we all have friends that who've maybe torn a ligament or anything like that. Like imagine that experience with needing to get back to like absolutely 100% of what your body can be to get back out there and play at the highest level of a sport. So even with the best intentions, I think those setbacks can happen, but the Wilpon scars are real and we are justified in feeling like it only happens to us as Mets fans.
My friend Eric Steven, who does the Three Inning Save podcast with the Dodgers, has talked about how it took him years to get over the like PTSD of being a Dodgers fan during the really, really disastrous period when the McCourts were just like, you know, they're basically the Wilpons West, right? And how it took a couple of years for him to even like, you know, begin to accept that the Dodgers were making good decisions. And I feel like that is the story of Mets fans everywhere with Steve Cohen. I think Mets fans have probably overcompensated and you know, the whole Uncle Stevie bullshit stuff that was happening was like the overreaction to that. But I totally understand the very real PTSD from the Wilpon era that we're all carrying with us.
Elevate your summer with Osea's best-selling body care set. It's everything you need for radiant summer skin on the go. Featuring travel sizes of Osea's clean, vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral skincare, like their best-selling Undaria Algae Body Oil. Right now, you can get the best-sellers body care set, a $78 value, 33% off. And use code SUMMER to save an additional 10%. That's an additional 10% off at OCEAMalibu.com, code SUMMER.
Anything you want to say about the Dodgers or Giants series in particular? Anything that stood out to you as particularly encouraging or troublesome?
No, I mean, I guess the big concern that people have is sort of the just what the rotation's doing, not getting deep into games. I mean, not even getting close to getting deep into
games. Yeah, I was going to say.
and generally a high walk rate and all that. To go back to what you said a little earlier, Hauser is the one pitcher who has just been awful. And in writing about the Mets series against the Cardinals this weekend, I said at the time of that trade, Hauser seemed like the headliner, right? And it's turned out to kind of be the opposite. But it's just four starts. It's probably a little soon to panic, but I do think that I don't know how many more like truly bad starts from Hauser and great starts from Christian Scott in Syracuse. How many more times does that happen before you say, hey, we have to give this a shot?
Right.
Scott is pitching in a way that, I mean, he's not going 7 or 8 innings every night, but the strikeouts are sky high. The walks are super low. Even his most recent start, he walks the first batter, gives up a 2-run home run, and then retires 18 batters in a row with, I forget if it was 9, 10, 11 strikeouts, whatever it was, just absurd, right? you love to see a pitcher be able to get past early mistakes and then just get into that groove. I don't know. I don't know how much longer to go with it. Before his most recent start, I was of the mindset that, look, Hauser's made, there was 3 starts at the time. It's probably too early to sort of pull the plug. But then he had a really bad one to follow that up. And it was against the Dodgers, but he should be better than this.
Well, yeah, clearly.
His strikeouts are down. His walks are way up. And he's got an ERA over 7. He's given up 1 home run. So if that fly ball luck kind of turns on him and everything else is the same, it could get really ugly. So yeah, that is my one area of concern. But it seems like there's a very easy fix.
Well, I mean, look, even if they really feel like Scott needs more time, there are other internal options that they could go with. You know, we haven't seen much of Joey Lucchese just yet this year, and that's probably for good reason. I know his velocity has not been what it should be, and there's a couple of issues, you know, obviously with that. But I also feel like there's plenty of people who, wouldn't mind with Jose Budo being a more regular part of this rotation, even after Kodai Senga returns. Max Kranick just got off the IL and was optioned to Syracuse. So there are other options here that aren't just, ride it out with Adrian Hauser for the rest of the season. Now, in terms of the Christian Scott of it all, do you get the impression just from, what you've read, what you've seen around, do you think that he is going to... Is he an early season call-up, or do you think he's a September call-up at this point?
I mean, my best guess would be somewhere in between. I don't know if they have any sort of inning limit in mind for him this year, and if they do, where that lies. I'm curious to see as teams continue trying to navigate pitching injuries, whether they continue to put innings caps on guys or really just go with lower pitch counts in each outing. I feel like the trend has been lightening workloads more and more, and the injury trend continues to go in the wrong direction anyway.
Yep.
So I don't know what the right answer is there. It gets talked about quite a bit throughout baseball these days, but I'll predict that Scott is making major league starts in June.
Okay.
Somewhat conservative, but I don't know. I if it gets to a point that he's every single time out there in AAA, he's just showing that he's kind of conquered that level, then what's the point if you don't give that person a shot at the big league level? And look, it's a new person in charge of baseball operations, but we did see the Mets do it. It's not like everybody's gone from the front office who was there a year ago. Mark Vientos, Brett Beatty, they got their shots when they hit really well early in the season. And neither of them panned out as a major league hitter last year. Ronnie Mauricio took a whole lot longer before he got major league at bats. And he had also gotten off to that sort of rip roaring start in Syracuse. We know there's a lot more to it than just a stat line. There are things that teams are looking for. They have access to all this information that we don't. But yeah, I would guess that Scott, even though he's a pitcher and not a position player, like those three guys, ends up a little closer to Beatty or Vientos' timeline than the Mauricio one.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I would say we're probably not going to see Scott until July would be my guess, because I just think that there's going to be a certain amount of conservatism in terms of bringing him up, quote, too early, whatever that really means. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see him, you know, early to mid-July, pre-All-Star break. And at that point, Senga should be back. We'll probably have a better idea about Hauser and Severino in terms of what their true 2024 talent looks like, as opposed to just a, you know, a handful of starts. We'll probably have a bit of a better idea about if Buto is continuing his, you know, his ability to look like a much better pitcher than all of us had him pegged to be. We'll have a lot more data to go with, and it will seem like it's a better, I guess they'll just feel like they will know what they're asking Scott to do at that point. Like right now, I don't know what they really think they're asking Scott to do. Are they asking him to be a number four starter? Are they asking him to be a number two starter? Are they, without Senga, are they really looking to him to be the number one starter? I mean, that's not realistic, but you know, if no one else is pitching effectively and pitching deep into games, they're going to be looking for him for a lot more. I think they're going to have a better sense of just like what is expected of him beyond just the immediate, this start that he's pitching in today. They need to have a better sense of sort of what his role on this team is going to be for the rest of the season. And I think by early to mid-July, they probably have that figured out. So that would be my guess. Give Senga a month or so in the rotation before they make any rash decisions.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I mean, that is logical. Look, there's other guys there too. You know, like you said, Lucchese is somebody who maybe gets a look. Dom Hamill had a really good start recently.
Yep.
And he's been pitching well. And really, Scott, Vassell, and Hamill. Vassell a little bit less so. He's just struggled in all of his starts. So, never mind. Remove him from this thought. But I mean, he's got plenty of time that he could bounce back and sort of figure that out. But Scott and Hamill both had not the greatest first start of the season, and then in their three more recent starts, they've been just fantastic. Hamill's got a 2.3 ERA, 24 strikeouts, 5 walks in his last three. Scott has a 2.70 ERA with 25 walks, 25 strikeouts, 4 walks in his last three starts. Those first couple of series that everybody played in Syracuse, there was a brief series in Syracuse and then they were in Scranton. The weather wasn't great. Everybody's just come up from spending 2 months or more in Florida, ramp it up for the season. And, they're sort of, you know, thrust into the chilly March and April upstate or Pennsylvania weather. Yeah. So yeah, it is nice that there's maybe four pitchers who are on that Syracuse roster right now that wouldn't scare me as somebody who's getting called up to make a major league start. That is depth that often has not been the case for the Mets. And you mentioned Kranick, he would be the fourth in addition to Lucchese, Scott and Hamill. And I happened to catch Kranick in Binghamton. I think I mentioned it last week.
Yeah, you did.
As well. But look, it's only double A, but he looked really good. Sometimes guys catch your attention in person. And he did. I don't know that necessarily means that he'd be a great major league starter, but I was impressed for somebody who I spent most of the last 3 months going like, who, what, yep. what does he do? He caught my attention, and I just based on that start that he made, I would not be scared to see him pitch a game for the Mets.
Yeah, that amount of pitching depth is really something we haven't been accustomed to in a while. You know, I think when people were talking about the Mets system in this offseason, there was so much talk of the young position players who were acquired in the deadline trades last year. And obviously those are still the marquee players in their system. But I don't think enough attention went to Christian Scott, Mike Vassell, et cetera, of having actual pitching prospects for the first time in a couple of years. So it is nice to see, even if, you know, just, I mean, to quote former Mets, I mean, to quote many people, but the first person I ever heard say it was former mostly Mets podcast host Toby Hyde, there is no such thing as a pitching prospect, you know, and pitchers break. So it's always good to have just lots of options there, even if they're not the most exciting options that are there. Let's talk to JD Martinez. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no, that Toby Hyde, blast from the past.
Yeah, I loved that Mostly Mets podcast. When it was Toby and Ted and Patrick Flood. It was a great podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
That might be the first Mets podcast I ever listened to, actually. Huh. That might predate Amazing Avenue Audio. Wow. I'm a trader. Yeah, I'm a trader to my own kind. Look at that. Anyway, let's talk JD Martinez for a minute, though. You know, we have not seen him play in a major league game as a Met. We didn't see him play in spring training as a Met. You didn't catch him in any of his rehab starts, did you? Did he play up north at all or no?
Well, he did, but I didn't.
Okay.
Make it. The Rangers had a playoff game on the same night. Okay. So
yeah. So
he had one game in Florida and two in Syracuse.
Yeah. Obviously, everybody has high expectations for him because he's JD Martinez and we know what he can do. But sort of what do you think the first couple weeks of JD Martinez as a Met will realistically look like? You know, how much of a difference do you see his bat making from jump?
I'd say quite a bit. And I mean, I know DJ Stewart's done a good job in his playing time so far this year. They've really gotten better performances, I think, than expected from a few of their hitters. But there just isn't a substitute. I mean, last year, Martinez had an isolated slugging over 300, which even by his own standards is very high.
Yes.
But this is a real power bat. And that's not to take away from Francisco Lindor, who has hit 30 home runs several times, including just last year as a Met. It's not to take away from Francisco Alvarez, who might have had a shot at that if not for getting 2 months of the season taken away by this thumb injury. But even with good performances up and down the lineup, there's just not somebody who can hit for power like that other than Pete Alonso. So, you know, I know Tim Britton wrote about sort of an age-old question about whether or not, like, lineup protection works or means anything. And to me, it's not so much that he's protecting Pete Alonso. It's more that Pete Alonso and Martinez back-to-back make for a pretty tough pair for a pitcher to have to try to get through. And look, to his credit, I feel like Alonso hasn't even been talked about that much during the season, but the guy's hit 7 home runs. He's hitting 263, 340, 516. And that is about a slash line that you think Martinez could replicate.
Right.
Last year, he was a little lower on base, but a higher slugging than that. But put those two hitters back to back in the middle of a lineup. Lindor will get back to his usual. And then all of a sudden, I'm not saying it's quite as, I don't know the right word for it, but it's not Juan Soto and Aaron Judge, but it's also not bad. And I think that impact will be felt close to immediately.
That's an interesting way of putting it in terms of how fast the impact will be felt. I don't know about that. You know, I am worried about him. I know he's a veteran player and doesn't need as many reps to get himself hot as a younger player may. But it just seems to me like he has not played a lot of rehab games. He didn't get spring training at all. You know, I mean, he was working out. I'm not impugning his work ethic or anything of the sort, you know, but it's a very different experience what he did this spring versus what the other 25 guys on the roster did for the spring. So I'm a little bit concerned about him coming out of the gate cold, but I wonder if the reputation of JD Martinez is almost as important in terms of that lineup protection idea, whether it's real or not, than the reality of JD Martinez is. You know, are people fearful enough of him that they will pitch more carefully to him, even if they know he's coming off of just a handful of games to prep for the season? I don't know. It's an interesting question to ask.
He'll get a chance to establish that fear very quickly.
Yeah. I do want to talk about the bullpen for a minute, and not just because you were our regular bullpen correspondent this offseason, but the bullpen has been excellent so far. The piece you wrote yesterday, you identified at least 5, if not 7 players that have been pitching, not just in flukish ways, but pitching really quality innings in the Mets bullpen, you know, so far this season. And obviously we all want that to continue, but the limited amount of starting pitching innings has really put a strain on the bullpen already. We've seen the churn. We've seen Michael Tonkin come and go since the start of the season. And it seems like the bullpen might be a tenuous place to put hope, only because of how bad the starting pitching has been in terms of going deep into games. So how are you feeling overall about the bullpen right now?
Pretty great. And hey, didn't expect to be saying that at this point of the year.
Right, yeah.
I mean, to their credit, the Mets did go out and make a bunch of moves. They just waited a long time to do it. Adam Ottavino in particular was someone who I felt like got a lot of negativity last year when he was, decent, capable, whatever. He hadn't replicated his 2022 season, which was very, very good. But to me, he didn't just become a total train wreck. And
he was also fighting uphill against the expectations of being Diaz.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think, and I, like I wrote about this too, that just the Diaz being back, his presence totally changes the mindset for everyone else in that bullpen on in terms of what they need to do. And that doesn't take away from their numbers, but when you have Edwin Diaz, who doesn't even look like he's fully back up to speed yet, and there's no reason to think that he can't get there. And it's crazy to say that a guy with I think it's a 1.04 ERA that he has right now, and it's like he's okay. He'll get better.
He'll do.
Ottavino is doing awesome work. Reed Garrett seems to be for real. And I think we all need to see a little bit more before we can fully make that conclusion. But Reed Garrett he leads the Mets bullpen in innings pitched. The strikeout rate just keeps staying Edwin Diaz levels of high. Ottavino has been great. Brooks Raley is currently dealing with some elbow inflammation, but as far as we know, the team has said that his MRI is clean, so they don't expect that he'll be out long term. He's been very good. Jake Diekman has started to round into form. Even Drew Smith has some issues that he probably needs to address, but the results so far have been good. look, right now, this is objectively a very good bullpen. And I think there's at least a chance that enough of these guys are for real that they stay within the top 10 in Major League bullpens. And obviously, you always want every component of your team to be the best, but we dealt with so many awful bullpens over the last 20 years that as Mets fans, having just a pretty good one or a great one is a real treat. So
absolutely.
It is still April. But similar to what you were saying coming out of spring training, I'd rather have a great first month of real games and those stats and take it from there than the opposite and wondering if it could ever possibly get better. So feeling good about it. Also was really glad that Edwin Diaz got into a game in a high leverage spot that wasn't just the ninth inning.
Yes.
We've seen the Mets do that quite a bit in 2022 with him. And they should continue to do so because it just, if I'm Adam Ottavino or Reed Garrett or Jake Diekman, and I'm like, well, you know, they gave the heart of the order to Diaz, but I've got this 1.9 or 2.2 ERA. I'm going to still feel pretty good about myself in terms of what I did.
Absolutely, yeah.
Hey, my stats are a little bit better. I know it's because this guy's on my team, but I don't care. Like, there's no shame in having somebody who's just that little bit better than you go out in those spots and take that off your plate. And deep down inside, I'm sure, like, maybe there's a couple, like, just pure baseball sociopaths like Max Scherzer out there who aren't afraid of anything and like don't have it. Like there's just no like, oh wow, like you want to face Juan Soto, have at it, right? Like I'm sure there's a few of those in bullpens around the league, but these guys are all human beings. There has to be some level of relief that you might not get the toughest assignment that day.
Yeah, I well said. Baseball sociopaths should also be the name of a punk band.
Hey, if Max Scherzer picks up a guitar, if he ever retires.
Yeah. Anything else to say about the Mets before we move on to our music recs?
No, I hope that as you hear this, they are in the midst of taking advantage of a Cardinals team that might be the worst one we've seen. I don't know about in our lifetime.
At least the last 25 years, right?
Yeah. Yeah, in quite some time. Like, going back to the 2006 NLCS, I don't think the Cardinals have been this bad since then. So I hope that they're looking that bad all weekend. I hope the Mets take advantage, and I hope we all get to enjoy that because it feels like one of those things that just doesn't come along all that often. So, you know, consider it the total eclipse of the Cardinals. Let's hope.
Let's hope so. I'm trying to see here when the last time that the Cardinals even had a losing record was. I don't know. That's not an easy thing to find. Like it's hard to find. There is no easy to find baseball reference page, which is like year to year records. Is there?
If you just do the search, general advice, if you just search Cardinals and then click on the franchise.
Oh, look at that. Yeah, that's easy.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, 2020 throws everything off when you're just scanning and looking at numbers. I mean, they weren't very good last year.
No.
Which I guess I kind of forgot.
No, but they were in it for a while. They won 78 games in 2007. So the last time they won less than 70 games, not counting obviously the pandemic year, was 95. So this
is a long time.
This could be the worst Cardinals team in a very long time, in 29 years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I did have one more Mets thought. I know the A's kind of teased maybe being worse than the 62 Mets last year, but the White Sox this year might really pull it off.
They may, yes. I have a couple of friends who are White Sox fans, and they are not happy.
No. I mean, they're 3-22. They're on pace. I think that's a 22-win pace. The 22-win pace was from when they were 3-21. They are on a 19-win pace right now.
My God.
Which would be half what the 62 Mets won. I don't know. Again, it's just April. And I'm not of the mindset that I don't want any team to ever be worse than the 62 Mets.
No, I have no idea what people are nostalgic. I think the Mets had,
right. Like, I would be totally fine with another team taking the worst season ever mantle. And I think there's some hope here. Especially because most of the rest of their division looks pretty good. So, yeah. Not my top priority in terms of Mets thoughts this season, but something to keep sort of on the back burner.
Yeah, man.
And the Astros might suck. That's fun, too.
That is so fun, too, yes.
Schadenfreude all around here at the end of this episode.
Have we talked about the A's moving to Sacramento next year yet?
I feel like, I mean, we've definitely mocked the whole process of moving to Vegas and the uncertainty. I don't remember if we specifically talked about them being a AAA team. It's a damn shame, you know, now that I've gotten all into Liverpool and European leagues and everything and fully understand how relegation works. And it's the whole organization should just be forced, like the A's should be forced to actually play in AAA and like bump all their affiliates down by one, make Major League Baseball a 29 team league until the A's do something that shows they deserve to be back in it. I know mathematically that doesn't work, but the principle of it, I hate that Major League games are going to be played in a AAA ballpark.
Is it 10,000 seats, I think they said?
Yeah, and then they might bring in some temporary stuff to put in the outfield for like an extra 5. But like, it's going to be a tourist destination for visiting teams. Like, nobody's right. Going to be an Ace fan.
I mean, you would figure that Sacramento is not that far from the Bay Area, so there probably are 10,000 A's fans in the Sacramento general region. But that said, like, to get them to all come to a game is unlikely, and also just the idea of a what does this do to the young players who are going to be coming up and playing their first full season of baseball in a place that's no different than the last, you know, couple of years of their minor league careers. It's such a weird thing for the players. It's a bizarre thing for the fans. And then after this, you know, this isn't even like, you know, when the Yankees played at Shea Stadium for a couple of years because of renovations to Yankee Stadium. Like, that's weird, right? But you're going back to your home base after that. They're never going back to their home base. They're going to be leaving this area to go to a new place. So they're going to have to basically build up a temporary fan base, then build up a permanent fan base, all with no real sense for how baseball in Las Vegas is going to work in terms of fan appeal, because it's, you know, we've only seen the 51s there and other minor league teams who have drawn well, but never drawn like gangbusters, you know. I really don't know what to think of any of this. It is such a weird thing. I think it sucks. That's what I think of all this. There is no upside to this, really. I'm really flummoxed by how this is going to work on almost every basic level.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I guess we have friends in Sacramento. But I believe their sports allegiances lie elsewhere in the country. But I guess theoretically, if I were an A's fan already, I'm living in Sacramento, I could go, hey, all right, they're going to play locally. I'm going to go to a bunch of games because this is the team I've always followed. But anybody who's going to games in Oakland, I think is out of pure disdain, is not going to go to games in Sacramento and will not follow the team to Vegas. I'm sure there's some exceptions, but like really a handful in this case. But yeah, it's a joke, and it really does make the league and the commissioner look like they don't have a handle on what's going on, that it came to this, and this is the best plan they could come up with. And it might even be 4 years. Like they said that up front, which anybody who's followed anything ever involving construction, if you're throwing out that there might be a delay before it even starts,
there's a delay. Yep. Yeah.
So 4 years in a AAA ballpark. I don't know. It's pretty pathetic, and it is not something. It shouldn't be something that's worthy of major league status. But alas.
That said, it would be kind of cool to see a Mets game in that ballpark, just for the novelty.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's it. Right. That's one of those. Hey, I'm going to be in. You know, maybe you could even make it work with. If it's a road trip where the Mets hit San Francisco and Sacramento.
Or Seattle and Sacramento. It's a little bit farther, but still, you know.
Yeah, I know, but it's doable. Like, you could potentially see the Mets in a couple of very unique environments.
Yeah.
In the same season. So
the real shame of this all, and of course I have to make it about me as we end the show here, is that my wife did her right after she graduated, she lived for a year in Sacramento, and this year is the 20th anniversary of that. And so she is going to Sacramento this fall. And I said, you guys should really delay your reunion a year and invite spouses next year so that I can go see the Mets. But, you know, that's not happening. So unfortunately for everyone involved, but especially for me. But yeah, that's baseball. That's the weird state of baseball right now. You have teams that are making more money than they've ever made in the history of the game. Players are finally starting to be compensated in a way that seems like it's maybe fair compared to the amount of money that they're making for these franchises. And you also have at the same time the A's, just the most mismanaged embarrassment of a franchise. It's such a weird time to be. Everything about baseball right now is very, very strange. And I think you have to place a good chunk of the blame at Manfred's feet. And, you know, they are very loath to change commissioners. So we're going to probably have this guy for a long time. Yuck.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, why don't you tell our listeners about your dream before you tell them the music pick?
Sure. I had a dream that I couldn't come up with an album pick. And every once in a while, as you know, if you listen every week and stick around for the music picks at the end of our episodes, I might not have something ready to go and defer to Brian. And then he has an album. And then I come up with one or finalize my decision and go second. In this dream, that happened. But then I just couldn't come up with a record at all. Like, not one. Couldn't think of a record. Woke up. Only podcast dream I've had to date that I can remember.
I've had many,
but I made an album pick an hour before we recorded today just to make sure I'd be safe. So all of that said, I have an album pick, as is also often the case, a little bit of a roundabout way of coming to it, but I been reading Wayne Kramer's autobiography or memoir, as we touched on earlier this year. Sadly, he passed away early in 2024, and I made an MC5 recommendation that you know just had to be done. But in reading his book and sort of like a lot of the music that was around and getting him into playing guitar and all that as a teenager, this artist wasn't mentioned directly, but in listening to a lot of the stuff that Wayne Kramer was talking about from those like early rock and roll days, throwing that at like the Spotify algorithm, essentially takes you down a path where a bunch of other similar artists come up. And Wanda Jackson is one of them. And she's still with us. She's retired. I believe she's in her late 80s now. But she had made a record with Jack White called The Party Ain't Over. It came out in 2011. I had the really good fortune of picking up. At the time, it felt like expensive tickets on StubHub. But if that sort of scenario were to happen again, Wanda Jackson with Jack White and his like Third Man Records band, I think it was like a 10-piece band or something, but they were playing a show at Music Hall Williamsburg, which for anyone who's been there, you know, that is a very small venue. Even though it wasn't a Jack White show, for a band, including a legendary musician and Jack White, that was a tiny show. So got to be there for it. See most of these songs played live in addition to some of her older stuff. And it was just it was a great time. Great show. The band was great. Obviously Jack White is a fantastic guitarist. And looking back through our music recs, I don't believe, unless he contributed something to an album that is, you know, didn't immediately identify on our spreadsheet, but I don't believe there's been a music rec on this show that has Jack White's guitar on it. So
that's somewhat surprising.
Yeah, I'd have to really go through it with a fine tooth comb to verify that, but I don't think that has happened. So, yeah, this record, I think she sounds great on it. It's mostly covers, including Thunder on the Mountain by Bob Dylan, Shaken All Over, which goes back much farther than just when The Who did it. But to me, The Who sort of like really defined that song on Live at Leeds and maybe on some of their other live records. But those songs, Rip It Up, an Amy Winehouse cover, You Know That I'm No Good, that is really great. Not a combination of things that I ever thought I would say, right? not because of Amy Winehouse, but just Wanda Jackson and Jack White got together and covered Amy Winehouse is not a thing that you would have expected ever. So, yeah, I like this record a lot. It definitely opened up listening to more of her older stuff. And I know like critical reviews of this record were a little hit or miss, but screw that. I'd say it's it's a fun listen. And everybody sounds good. And it wasn't the first time that Jack White had made, you know, he did the record with Loretta Lynn, very yeah. different style of music, you know, but he's connected with some of these older musicians and made albums with them, which is something that I think is pretty cool to get to do, obviously for the artist, but also cool for fans to get to hear. Jeff Tweedy and Mavis Staples.
Johnny Cash.
And Ben Harper. Yeah. Ben Harper and Mavis Staples also made a record together. Yeah, it's fun to see that sort of those generational connect gaps be bridged by really good musicians. So
I have a really important question for you though here.
Sure.
Does Wanda Jackson keep the line about Alicia Keys in Thunder on the Mountain?
Oh. That's a good question.
Because I remember at the time, that was a big deal that Bob Dylan cited Alicia Keys in the lyrics of that song. So I wasn't sure if she kept it up or not. So,
yeah, I'll have to listen.
Yeah, listeners.
Like more closely.
Yeah, listeners, go check that out. If not, I always find it funny when people sub out a different artist, like in those situations. I heard somebody cover Surrender by Cheap Trick once, and instead of saying they got my Kiss records out, it was they got my Trick records out, right? Like referencing Cheap Trick. So I always find it interesting when people update those references. But yeah, excellent pick, Chris. I'm looking forward to revisiting that. I haven't heard that album since it came out, so I'm looking forward to revisiting that. My pick comes from an offhand comment made to me this week. So I am currently playing bass in a pit band for a high school production of The Addams Family. A friend of mine does local theater stuff, and a couple times a year I'll get hired to play bass or guitar in these pit bands. And the drummer and I are good friends, and we both have very similar taste in music. They were talking about what show they're doing next year, and someone said they think they're doing The Descendants. And the drummer looked at me and goes, Milo goes to college? And I said, The Descendants is a Disney Channel show that's now a musical, but he was referencing the punk band. And I said, no, Milo goes to the theater. And then he goes, showage. It was always doing all these like Descendants references back and forth. And I realized I have never picked one of my absolute favorite punk rock records of all time. And that is The Descendants' Milo Goes to College. Came out in June of 82, the month I was born. I'm sorry, recorded in June of 82, the month I was born. So I like to think that when I came into the world, I brought some Milo Goes to College energy with me, and The Descendants, you know, soaked it up and made a record out of it. But it is what I love about early punk rock, and I've probably said this in the show before, is that they're really punk was not a style of music. It was an attitude, and it was a way of doing things. And so like The Descendants played a ton of shows with Black Flag, even though they don't sound like Black Flag at all. They're way more melodic. If you like any sort of what is considered pop punk now, this is sort of the starting point for that. They are not pop punk. I would say they are maybe melodic hardcore. I hate all these terms. They all sound fake, but it definitely is like a proto pop punk type sound, really melodic songs. But the band is just so interesting. Like, so Milo Aukerman, who was the singer, the reason the record's called Milo Goes to College is because they were a band, and Milo was going to college, and they were breaking up because he was going to college. And then this album did well, and so he would come home from college and would do more shows with them. But eventually he became a legit scientist, and still balances a science career with a punk rock career. But also their bassist, Tony Lombardo, was, I believe, like 15 or 20 years older than the rest of the band. He was a local guy to where they were from in Southern California. And so he played with them. But like, it's a crazy to think of like this 18-year-old kid playing with a 40-year-old bass player or a 35-year-old bass player. Like, but his songs fit really well into the Descendants, like, world. It's such a fun album. It is funny in parts. It is super catchy. Like so many albums of this era, it comes and goes in, like, I look up the time now, but like it cannot be more than, let's see, how long is it? 22 minutes long. It's so you get 15 songs in 22 minutes. And Bill Stevenson is one of the great drummers in punk rock. He played with Black Flag for a number of years. After The Descendants, he formed the band All, which was an offshoot of The Descendants. And really smart lyrics, really funny stuff. And if you don't know Milo Goes to College, you probably should. So that's my pick for this week. The Descendants, Milo Goes to College. I like how our music picks could not have less in common, Chris. That's fun. It's good. Anyway, thank you all for listening. We appreciate it. Go to homerunapplesauce.com for more information. Follow us on Instagram at BrianEatsANApp, at Chris McShane, and we will talk to you soon. But until then, let's go Mets.